Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McKusick, and we're back for part two of the discussion against the offense against the Green Bay Packers. What an offensive performance it was as the Ravens rolled over the Packers 41-24. We get to be happy for a day, and then it found out less than 24 hours later, we get to be happy for another week as we await the last game. It'll be New Year's Day on, Thursday? I guess it is New Year's Day. That will be the ninth anniversary of a game the Ravens lost to the Cincinnati Bengals on 1-1-17. That game has some significance in Ravens history, and I'd like you to send me what the significance of that game was, okay? And send it to me in a direct message, if you would. I'd love to hear from you, and I'll just announce who the winner is. There's no prize other than bragging rights, and if you can tell me what that means. The deadline is New Year's. I'll make it New Year's Eve at midnight. Okay, so I can hear anytime by then. We'll be good for getting that information out. I'll announce it then. Anyway, the Ravens, big win, largely due to a fine offensive line performance, as I would state it. Now, we're getting into the grades a little bit here, and I want to preface things a little bit because this was a really good example of how two different grading systems can have two very distinct views on how effective the linemen were in this game. All right. So I'm not going to bitch and moan about PFF system isn't good because of A or B or C or D or whatever it might be. I'm just going to say, you know, the value of run blocks as I score them, particularly of missed run blocks, is not nearly as serious as what PFF ascribes to them. And the value of having no penalties, which the Ravens had across the offensive line, none in this game, is very high. And normally they're a big source of the points lost. And other than that, the Ravens offense looked pretty good, and we'll talk about why and some of the big differences by player that occurred. One very big one in particular. So in short synopsis, Huntley took just one sack in the game. It was not on the offensive line. There was a pressure on the play. Let me look back at that play and remember exactly what it was. It was a sack for zero. Occurred, I believe, on the third drive. Yep, the third drive. And Andrews was beaten inside by 58 to force the flush and the eventual RL0 on the play, which was a sack zero. So Huntley took the chance, held onto the football, thought he could get away from the defender. Looked like he actually dove forward for about a yard. But anyway, they marked it as no gain, which meant it was a sack since it was an attempt to pass to start the play. So that was the one sack they allowed. It didn't have anything to do with the offensive line. Now, it was still only 21 pass plays, and the offensive line allowed 7 pressures and 2 quarterback hits, which is a lot for that few number. We did hear the first episode we were talking about ample time and space and pressure, that it was 2 ample time spaces and 11 pressures. Well, 9 of the 11 pressures were the responsibility of the offensive line, but they only let Huntley get hit twice and knocked down, which is pretty good. They were not flagged in 73 snaps. And I think maybe most importantly coming out of this game is I think the offensive line did a great job converting back to more power successfully as it was incorporated back into the offense. You think you can just turn the switch on and off like robots? Well, I mean, these guys got to relearn how to do some of these things or focus on doing some of these things even more successfully to make the power schemes work. They did, and it was extraordinarily successful against a Green Bay team dealing with their own health challenges in this game. So it was one of, frankly, the most lopsided rushing performances in team history. I gave you a couple games early on in that first season, the 2020 season finale against the Bengals, where they ran for 404, the 2009 wildcard game, where they ran for, I think it was about 250 in that game. That was with Flacco, though, and they ran all over the New England Patriots in that game, and Flacco only threw 10 passes, and they still won. Let's go individually to some of the performances here. Ronnie Stanley probably struggled the most as a pass blocker in this game of any lineman. He did give up 3.5 pressures. He allowed 1.5 of the 2 quarterback hits, and he allowed one penetration. It was a play where he failed to make a run block. He actually, what happened? He failed to pick up Enagbare on the left side. He actually kind of looked like he tripped over his left leg as he was trying to get over to make the block, and Enagbare got back him, and he blew up the play, even though I don't think he made the tackle for a loss of two. Mitchell got turned around, then he fell flat on his face, and he pounded the ground without realizing or without thinking that he hadn't been touched yet, and he could have gotten up and tried to make another yard, but he ended up getting touched down at that point, and that was a loss of two and a two-point loss for Stanley on that play. The pressures cost him 7 points. The quarterback hits cost him 4.5 points. He ended up with 47.5 out of a possible 73. So that's 0.65 per play. Now, one thing that's nice about a game like this is there's a lot of time to make up for your problems when you have 73 offensive snaps that are scored, 74 in total, and one was a kneel, so he wasn't involved in that. But you got a moderate adjustment, I would say. I had to tuck it down a little bit because he also got run out of a pressure by Huntley at one point. Huntley ran for a 5 yard, it was a 9 yard gain actually on third and four on the third play of Q4. But he was bowled by Van Ness. That flushed Huntley, and then Huntley actually made a play out of it and ran for a first down. Anyway, a C for the game for him. I'll give you some of the nice things, though. He had 5 blocks in level two. So Stanley has still been very mobile in his outstanding run since the bye. Pre-bye, he was hurt and not playing well. Post-bye, he's been terrific. And the mobility has been one of the really big things. It's been nice to see. He's running sideline to sideline. He's running downfield a fair amount. And we're seeing good things happen in terms of that. So 5 level 2 blocks is always nice to get out for that many against a tackle. That was the fewest level 2 blocks of any of the Ravens offensive linemen. So now you have some things to look forward to here. So pancakes, he had none. Pulls, 1 out of 1. I mentioned they did some counters in this game. And I think his pull might actually have been a pull left. No, it was part of a two-man. Yeah, it was part of a two-man pull from center and left tackle. And I believe it was going to the left on a play that was on their last real drive when they had a 3 yard run to the left. Anyway, 4 highlight blocks. It was a bunch of different stuff, but I think it was mostly combinations in his case. So 1, 2, 3 combinations. So 0R. Yeah, looks like 4 combination blocks in his case. So nice ability to pin for the guy next to him, whether that was a tight end or Voorhees, but he made the initial block at the line of scrimmage, then moved to level 2 and made a 2nd block. So well done on his case. And a C overall, you're going to get some Cs, and it's not that bad a situation. In fact, there's some players you wish they'd just get a C every week, and it'd be a big improvement from where they are. Stanley is a guy who's played better than that in the second half of the season. And just looking at the offensive line score sheet as we go through for the year so far, Stanley's grades since week 8 are now C, C minus, C plus, C minus, A, B, C plus, C, A, C. So there have been a lot of Cs, but there hasn't been anything lower than a C minus that entire time. And that's really something. I think I'd say he's playing at a C plus level overall since then. Might even say a B minus level. It's very close because you think about it, he's aggregated positives that might put him to a higher level if you're thinking the old PFF scoring method, say. But I thought he gave up a fair amount of pressure in this game. That was obviously with only 21 pass plays to give up as many pressure events as he did is not a good thing. But I thought he looked good as a run blocker. Let's move over to Voorhees. Had a solid game despite a number of missed blocks in this one. Now, he's similar to Fa'alele in this game in a lot of respects. And he didn't make a bunch of pass blocking errors, but he did have a bunch of missed blocks. So he missed 12 blocks, and then he missed 2 others that were pressure events. One a shared pressure with Stanley, the other a shared quarterback hit with Stanley. So he didn't get a full share of anything, which meant he only lost 2.5 points on the total of his pressure events. But then he had 12 missed blocks as well, which is 0 for 12 on those 12 blocks. Works out to 0.77 per play. Gave him a small adjustment, got him up to 80. Before or after adjustment, he would have had a C. either way. Now, he did some nice things in terms of mobility. He had 8 blocks in level 2, did not have a pancake, made 8 out of 11 pulls. He's dropped back a little bit from just an outstanding pull streak he had at midseason, which was near perfect for a number of weeks there. He's fallen off that a lot. But, you know, going at 8 out of 11 on pulls, nothing wrong with that in a game. Most times you would take that. Those pulls have higher value, and they're also more difficult blocks. And so when a player has an exceptional pull game, like they go 7 for 7 or something, I'll bang up their adjustment an extra point or two to reflect that. Anyway, they had he had one highlight in the game, that was it. Gets a C for the game, same as Stanley. And again, nothing wrong with that. It's an average performance. Everybody else was better than the two guys on the left side. Let's talk about them. So the next one is Linderbaum, who had a simply amazing game. Now, we'll start with the bad news first, right? Because you always do that when you have to tell people good news and bad news. He did miss 8 blocks. Now, when you have a lot of run blocks, that often will happen. You're having to connect on these blocks. You don't always get it done. The center is usually the best at knowing exactly where he has to be on his run block and on his pass block, because he's making that call for the line as a whole. But Linderbaum still managed to miss some, and he managed to get beat on some. In this game, 8 missed. Was a fair portion of the score he lost in this game. If you think about 11 points came off those 11 points in terms of the deduction from 100, if you want to think of it, came on this missed blocks. He also had a pressure allowed. PFF did not consider this a pressure, but this is a difference in the definitions of the systems. He was clearly in the cone within about 1.5 yards of Huntley. Huntley had a half step into his throw on that play. I don't remember if it was complete or not, but it's definitely a pressure in terms of Linderbaum. So 62 points overall, 0.85 points per play, which is okay at center. It's not great, but it's okay. And then he had a 0.07 adjustment. I never give a center that higher an adjustment, so I've got some explaining to do of why I would do that. I gave him 0.92 overall and an A-. Now, here are the reasons. He had 18 level 2 blocks in this game. That is the highest total I can ever recall. Any player, any game, I've been doing this for 20 years, 100,000 blocks, closer to 120,000 blocks by now, and no guy's ever had a game with 18 level 2 blocks. He had 2 pancakes, made all 4 of his pulls, and had 4 highlight blocks during that as well. So simply an outstanding game. He was a bully physically that I haven't seen, but he had some nice late pushdowns that were like one notably on a pancake in level 2 on, I think it was number 94. He knocked to the ground late. Love to see him finish. Would love to see him do it even more. I thought he did something this game that was better in terms of his combination blocking. So even when he was climbing, he didn't do a lot of the kind of the bump and go climbs, where I think he oftentimes, one of his weaknesses as a run blocker, even though he's very strong in general in that category, is that he doesn't do enough to engage and get the man at the line of scrimmage off balance so the guard can really finish him. I thought he did a better job of that in this game. He had some other plays where it wasn't even a duo block. He would just go to level 2 and line up his blocking that very effectively as well. If you look at the first run by Huntley, it wasn't the first run of the game by Huntley, but it's a 25-yard quarterback draw where they basically baited all 4 of the pass rushers to take an outside non-containing lane on Huntley, and the entire middle of the field was open. There were 2 players in front of, I believe it was him and Ali, who had to make the blocks on 1 inside linebacker. And basically, he let Ali make the block on the inside linebacker, made sure he had it, and then passed him and went through into level 3 to find a block. You would not see that kind of a patience normally. I think it was the right call, and ended up being Huntley getting a 25-yard gain on the play. It certainly looked like the right call on that play, and he did eventually find somebody to block in level 2. It wasn't like he had to go unfed because of it. Where is that 25-yard play here again? Let's find it. Okay, right. It's middle to late Q quarter 2. Yeah, I don't have who he blocked on that play, but he did find a block in level two. So anyway, outstanding game for Linderbaum, an A-. I think one of the things the Ravens really need to find out over the next few games is whether or not Tyler Linderbaum is the right player, if the power identity is going to be what they hold on to, whether it's for the playoffs or they're going to maintain more of the Roman DNA for the 2026 offense. Whichever way they're going with this, I think that Linderbaum's performance with that's going to be very important. Whoever he's got playing there, it doesn't matter if it's Emory Jones, it probably will be Voorhees at left guard. More than likely, I would say, not a sure thing, but you know, certainly the majority chance, not just plurality chance, would be that Voorhees is the starting left guard for the Ravens next year. There's a very limited chance that Daniel Falele will be the right guard for the Ravens, but it could be somebody very much like him, like a bigger bodied, kind of slower footed guy, like an Emory Jones. He'll have to learn to work with that. And he's played quite well now for a number of weeks. So going back to the bye for him, after a really bad start for him the first few games, he had A-, F, A, D, A, C, C+, C, and now an A- in this game against Green Bay. So he's had five grades of A- or better in the last, 10 games. So that's a good way to get paid if you're Tyler Linderbaum. He hasn't allowed a whole lot in terms of quarterback hits and sacks during that time, half a sack, 1.25 quarterback hits during that entire 10-game period, which is a nice run for him. He has allowed some pressures, so it hasn't been perfect, but 12 pressures in 10 games is actually pretty good, even for a center. So I think if you look at what he did, he had 1 5-yard penalty the entire 10-game period. He's really helped his case to get paid closer to what he probably wants in the Ravens. And after this game, thinking about where the Ravens are, I'd probably bump it about another million in terms of what I'd be willing to pay him. So if the Ravens are coming in and he's at anywhere between 17 and 18 million, I'm probably on board with, or I'll be saying that's about the right price on. I know there are a lot of people out there who say that's too much to pay for a center, and I'm not going to disagree entirely, but I think he's a really important starting point for rebuilding this line in a meaningful way. If you don't get that, you have to go to probably use your second round pick on getting a center, and you have to hope you really hit the jackpot on a player like, well, if you get Creed Humphrey, you'd more than hit the jackpot. You've hit the best player in the game. But if you get a player like Zach Frazier, who's probably a better center than Linderbaum at this moment in time, then you hit the jackpot as well, and you have him for 4 years at that price, almost no price. One of the problems with Linderbaum is not only has he earned some escalators along the way, which has improved his cost or made his cost worse, but he certainly put himself in a position where they couldn't pick up the 50-year option no matter what on him, even if they thought they could maybe pay left tackle money because of the Pro Bowls and whatnot and the All-Pro. You know, I think he is an All-Pro yet, but from the Pro Bowls, they couldn't pick up the additional cost of that option. So reducing those frictions is just an unfortunate nature. I wish the NFL would do it right and separate the positions so that all the offensive linemen, you know, whether you're they could put all the guards together, all the tackles together, and all the centers together. I think that would be fine. But you can't. What they've done now is just it's hosing teams, and it's making it less likely that teams will draft centers early on because of it, because you don't have those natural frictions to work with in terms of the keeping a star player around. So I don't know what Linderbaum's head is right now, whether he's going to be okay signing with the Ravens after kind of they've held him up a little bit on negotiations. But my guess is they probably remain cordial. He would probably like to stay with Lamar Jackson. So we'll see how this plays out. And again, I think it's a case of right player, right price. If Linderbaum thinks, well, my number's been going up while we've been going along too, and now it's $21 million per year, it's good luck to you in future endeavors. That's what it would be for me right now. But, they're going to go into the playoffs. He's a very important player for them to produce during any playoff run they may have. And hopefully he makes himself a lot of money either way, whether it's here or somewhere else. Let's move on. We'll talk about Daniel Falele, who I scored it as a B- for the game. He's right on the B minus B line, in fact, for me. He had one pressure allowed during the game, so not a significantly bad pass blocking game. He did get beat on some other pass blocking plays, by the way, but that was not a significant number of his total misses in the game. Most of these 11 missed blocks he had in the game were L2NB or misses on pulls. And I'm just going to read them off to you as I go. So second play of the game, 12-yard run, L2NB. Four plays later, he had an L2 whiff on 56. Go to the second drive. Late in the second drive, he had a whiff on 76. That's an at the line of scrimmage loss, so that's worse. Then he had a missed pull where Van Ness corkscrewed under him. You may remember the play, and then took down, I think it was Henry, for no gain on the play. Real close whether I would have called that a pancake and a scoring block for Falele or not. I looked at it a few times. I eventually decided I was not going to give him credit for it since Van Ness made the tackle. It was Henry on that play. Very next play, he whiffed on Van Ness on a pull. Then he went L2NB. Then he was beaten inside and had his face crossed. That's a bad one. That's a loss at the line of scrimmage on a run for four. Then he whiffed on 56 in level two. Again, not as serious a miss. Then he was backed up by 91 on what ended up being a run play. Not sure if it was that way to start with on this one, or if this is a quarterback scramble of some sort, because I don't have it marked that way. But he was backed up by 91, so that's a loss at the line of scrimmage. That's three of those in the game. He had an L2 whiff on 56 again. Then he had an L2NB, and that's all of them. So out of his 11 missed blocks, he only had three losses at the line of scrimmage, and those are the ones that are the killers. You can't lose to the man opposite you one-on-one and get beaten left, beaten right, get driven back on pass plays where it maybe would have been a pressure if the ball hadn't come out quickly. That obviously does not carry good portent for the remainder of your pulls. So most of his problems were right at the were in level two or on pulls, and that's the better kind of miss that you can have. Neither is good, but it's a better kind of miss. He did have six level two blocks in the game, had two pancakes, went 5 of 7 on his pulls. So we pulled his pants down on the two pulls already. He had 5 out of 5 otherwise that he got. There was still plenty of indecision in his game, but I'd say more than that, we saw more inability due to foot speed and quickness to get the blocks in level two. And that could be a problem, by the way, for the power game, that if you're going to leave Linderbaum as the trailing blocker on some plays and have Falele be the climber, he's going to be less able to do the things you need him to do to go find that guy in level two. So I think a lot of times it's going to be more often than not, it'll be good for Falele to be the trailing guy. And if there's any ability for Linderbaum to get that guy a little bit off balance, or the two of them to get him a little bit off balance as that starts off as a dual block, or him and Rosengarten for that matter, then Falele can be a good finisher. And we saw him get much more push in this game, I thought. I did notice that PFF scored him just terribly in this game. They scored him in the 40s on both sides. And to me, that's probably a what I would call a problem of pyramiding of error. So they've got a set of rules that they'll give a minus 0.5 or a minus 1 as an underlying score to Falele for some of these L2NBs and some of these other plays that were misses on pulls and whatnot. I don't look at them nearly as harshly. That's pretty clear as I'm discussing. So if he had, for instance, if all of those misses came on run blocks and they didn't, then he'd have missed 11 out of 53 possible points on runs, and that would be not, you know, that would still be about 80% he would be scoring on those. That's not the way PFF looks at it. They're trying to get offset value there, and I think the problem is that they're too harsh with their minus 0.5s and minus 0.1s on run blocks, because they're not as important, and they're too light on players who are getting penalties. And penalties are enormously significant, and I've talked about this before, but Falele, that's one of the things he's really cleaned up. Well, generally, the Ravens have cleaned up that about their offensive line play. But Falele's had a good year in terms of not having a lot of penalties assigned to him. He's lost 14 points for the year in 16 games on penalties. So That's a pretty good number. Had one holding call. Might have had two holding calls. I'm looking back at the Kansas City game. He might have had a hold in that one, or it might have been a 5-yard penalty and another 5-yard penalty that could not be declined, like a false start. But anyway, he said he's had a minimal number of penalties this year. It's been one of the good things about his game. I looked at it multiple times. I tried to figure out why is there such a big difference, but that's all I can come up with in terms of how PFF grades these things in a relative sense, is that there's a pyramiding of value. I'll just say a pyramiding of scoring, that he did a lot of a thing that PFF puts a higher weight on than I do negatively. That's the best way I can say it without saying that I don't think they're right, but I do stand behind my weightings. This is my background, is in trying to relatively valueize things and put a relative value on things. And I feel very confident about the way I do it. Anyway, let's move on. Good game for Falele anyway. I don't know if I talked about this level 2 blocks and whatnot. Talk about Rosengarten real quick. 73 plays for him, 62 blocks, 9 missed. He allowed 1 penetration. That was towards the end of the game, as I recall. No, I have it wrong. It was more like in the middle of the game. Yeah, when Henry was taken down for a 5-yard loss by Enagbare, it seemed like an important play at the time because it brought up a 3rd and 14, and they forced the Ravens to punt on their first drive of the second half. But that run right for -5 was Rosengarten getting beaten inside by Enagbare, who made that play. And then he had 1 pressure allowed. Still scored 58 points. That's 0.79 per play. Really close whether or not he would have gotten an A- or an A even for this game, because he did a lot of other things well, but I ended up giving him a B with a 0.05 adjustment. This is where it really gets incredible. And I gave you the level 2 blocks. Rosengarten had 11 level 2 blocks. That's a tackle with 11 level 2 blocks in a game. He had 4 pancakes. He made 4 of his 5 pulls. He had 2 highlights. They're both highlight combination blocks. Look at him in the article if you want the better definition of that. Got a B score overall. I could have been more generous with him, but I didn't think his quality of opponent was as high as some of the other others that were faced in this game. So I made it only 0.05 for the this year, I should say. So I made it only 0.05 for this game and a B. Again, another player who's playing a lot better. The Ravens offensive linemen in general have played pretty well since the bye. This 4 consecutive Bs for Rosengarten. Since the bye, he's had A-, A, C, D, B, C+, and then 4 straight Bs. So nice run. And the Ravens, one of the nice things about this team is they go into next year without a significant problem at tackle, which that is a place you want to be when you go into the draft. Is not absolutely needing an offensive tackle, because you've got all those other teams are going to be biting their fingernails on offensive tackles. The Ravens say, oh yeah, let that cornerback drop to us, or let that pass rusher drop to us, or let that 3-tech drop to us. This is a good year for the Ravens to not have a tackle need. It feels like it's been forever since they've been in that position where they really didn't need a tackle. That doesn't mean they won't take a swing guard tackle late. They might do that, but they're 3 primary guys with Vinson, Stanley, and Rosengarten. I go to war with those guys next year with no problem, as them being 1, 2, 3, and where they are. All right, so that's it for the offensive line. We did also have Corey Bullock came in the game for 1 scored snap as a 6th offensive lineman. That was down in goal line on just a horrific play for the Ravens offensive line. They missed everybody on that play, but they Bullock in particular made his block on that play, and a bunch of zeros around him. Henry still got in the end zone. Actually didn't. He came up short on that play, and then he scored on the next one. So anyway, that was Bullock's 1 snap. 3 of them got in for the final snap of the game. It was not a scored snap because it was a kneel. So Bullock was in, Vincent was in, and Emory Jones was in all for that last kneel down. Obviously, that doesn't mean a damn thing in terms of the future. Let's talk about some individual skill position players, because there were some good games around here. I can feel my dog's going to make the rest of this episode very difficult. Come on, get in your chair there. Get in your chair. All right. Hopefully you're going to hear some clicking around, but not too much. Flowers made a few decent plays. He protected the football very well after the catch, I thought. The other thing he did well is he got in the end zone on the 10-yard play. It was he had the first down, I believe, because I think it was on 3rd and 8 from about the 10-yard line, but it was a 10-yard touchdown pass, reached across the line, got in. The ball did come out, as it is wont to do, but it was, in this case, since we knew the rules of the catch so well from Likely's unbelievable play versus the Steelers a couple weeks ago, he had step, extend in this case, and that that clearly was enough to have made the football move to get across the goal line, and they granted the touchdown there without review, even though the Packers were calling for it. Flowers could be a much bigger weapon if you don't have Tyler Huntley in the game. So Tyler Huntley minimizes the value of Zay Flowers. He still did some things to help the Ravens in this game. He's still the most dangerous receiver they have. But if you're not willing to throw over the top of the defense, or you're not willing to wait a little bit for a crossing route between level two and level three to develop, Zay Flowers doesn't help you in the way he can help you. If he has to come back to get the football, that minimizes the use of Zay Flowers. We saw Tyler Huntley do that to Marquise Brown. He made Marquise Brown be a 5-yard A-dot receiver during his time with Huntley in 21 and 22. Actually, he wasn't here in 22. They traded him before the 22 season. So it was really during 21. And I think that was probably one of the reasons why Marquise Brown wanted out of Baltimore. And the Ravens made a great trade. They had a heist from the Arizona Cardinals on that trade. Then they used the pick on Tyler Linderbaum, which still was a lot of value to get, but it might not have maxed the value in that first round. Anyway, Flowers, good game for him, you know, but he's not at his best without Lamar Jackson and the opportunity to extend plays and impact the middle of the field between level two and level three. We got to talk about Derrick Henry. Now, he set so many records, moved to the top 10 in rushing, passing Tony Dorsett, became the first Raven ever to have 4 rushing touchdowns in a game. Do you remember that from Married with Children? That's what Al Bundy always gained, 4 touchdowns in 1 game, you know, kind of thing. He would always bring that up whenever there was some talk of him playing high school football. And it's 6 times the Ravens had guys who've had 3 touchdowns in a game. Ingram had done it, and Gus Edwards had done it, and Jamal Lewis had done it twice. And anyway, all those guys wiped out of the record book, and he's the first with 4, and he got it on the Ravens' last meaningful offensive play with a 25-yard run to pay dirt that got it done. Great game for Henry. Didn't have a ton of missed tackles, as I mentioned in the first episode, I believe. 6 on 36 carries is not particularly exceptional, but he did do other things well. I thought he took advantage and he extended some of the runs he had. I still can't believe 56 ran him down for that shoestring tackle on the right sideline. I thought he's gone for sure on that one, but he got a little piece of him. Maybe Derrick Henry 5 years ago scores on that play. I'm not worried about it, but you know, it was unfortunate that he missed out just a little bit on what had happened. All right. Let's talk a little bit about Keaton Mitchell. Didn't have as good a game, but he did have a nice burst to the outside. The announcers were picked up right away that was entirely a speed play created by Mitchell to get to the outside, as opposed to blocking scheme that set it up for him. And it's really nice to have that. It was almost a 90-degree outside cut, and then another bump to the outside. He finally hits the edge and races past people. Another case where he might have had a chance to burst through for a touchdown, but he ends up getting caught for I think a 14-yard gain on that right sideline. Talk a little bit about Walker in this game. Now, Walker didn't have a target in this game. What I found interesting is Walker was in at wide receiver when the Ravens ran a tush-push play. And you don't have wide receivers on a tush-push play. You have tight ends. So Walker actually lined up tight to the formation and is acting like he's going to knock somebody over as a tight end. I mean, I like multiple things about that. First of all, I love the fact that Walker seemed to be excited about doing it. Okay, so that's a positive if he's in there wanting to block on a play like that. The second is, I love that the Ravens sold the play that way. Now, every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything. Data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove. You know, the Packers are not stupid. They knew some form of that was coming, but when they saw Walker on the field, they might have thought, oh, this might be something else. I don't remember if the Ravens actually changed personnel for that play, but if they didn't, that would make the most sense, is that they just left who they had on the field, and then the Green Bay wouldn't have had a chance to bring on a bunch more heavies. If they did so, they would have taken a significant risk of a 12-man on the field penalty to get it done. And then, you know, by the time they lined it up, then, the Green Bay helmets were basically all in the neutral zone. One of them moved a little bit, and Linderbaum touched him up with his left arm, which I think he's allowed to move anyway. I talked about that in the first show as well. So very nice play there to get the NZI foul. And, Walker didn't have a ton of snaps in this game. At least I don't recall him having a ton of snaps. Let's take a quick look at it here. So Walker did play 20 snaps. That's 26% of the time, which actually surprises me a little bit. Flowers was out there for 52 snaps, Bateman for 40. So they weren't going all with the heavy personnel, but the fact that they used 2.19 heavies per play tells me, and that you've got slightly over one running back per play to add to that, means they should have had less than two wide receivers per play on. And I guess, one of the things is they had, 70 plus snaps. So those wide receiver snaps are a little bit watered down, but they had, they had enough snaps in the game to give even a player like Walker, who's fairly far down in the depth chart, 20 snaps, Hopkins 19, and Wester 7. So they got guys on the field a little bit. Still would love to see Wester used at some point for a package of three or four plays they have ready for him, to get one of them used in a game, or two of them used in some game, where he could be one of these gadget orbit guys that you would use closer to the line of scrimmage instead of wasting Flowers there. So it'd be nice to see that done. They have not done it as yet. Rashad Bateman, kind of a missing man in this game, had 40 snaps. He's targeted once for a 7-yard completion. He did something to make the most of it. Now, it's interesting because Bateman is a guy who should benefit from the fact that Huntley is a quarterback. Bateman is the Ravens' best route runner. He's the guy who can get separation at the top of the stem. There is a problem with that, though. If the other team always knows you're going to come back to the quarterback as opposed to trying to beat them deep, then they don't respect the deep routes, and they sit on the comeback routes. They sit on the curl. They sit on the, any kind of dig route that you might be running. That's a dig is even a little deeper, so you normally wouldn't, might not be anything even that deep. They sit on comebacks on the sideline a lot of the time. And, they play Tyler Huntley's arm as opposed to the wide receiver. So the fact that Bateman is a great route runner and can run anything you'd ask him to, it doesn't come into play. So, Bateman, of all the plays, should be least impacted by the fact that it's Huntley, but in a sense, they still are able to sit on what he can do at the top of the stem. Mark Andrews had a pretty good game. He had a very big play on that first drive to extend the football for a first down. That was really one of the key plays on that drive. They probably would have gone for it anyway. He caught all four balls thrown to him for 28 yards. So, and the longest was 9. So you can tell if the average is 7, the longest is 9, and he had 4, that he was catching a lot of mid-range balls there. And those are effective extensions of the run game, as I would think of it. And contributions to the low variance output of the Ravens offense that made them so unbelievably efficient in this game. Isaiah Likely did some good things. So he caught 3 out of 3 balls for 27, 9 yards. He had his the longest play of the day for the Ravens. It was an 11-yard catch, but then they tossed on a 15-yard unnecessary roughness for a helmet-to-helmet hit that he took. And that was a big play on, I believe, the second drive to get him down closer. Let's see where the 11-yard play occur. Just so we know, that was actually on the 2-minute drive at the end of the half, and that was getting those 26 yards was a big play, along with a 25-yard run by Huntley in terms of putting the Ravens down in range to score a touchdown there, and they did finally with Henry running it in. You see, we're talking about all these individual receivers, and they didn't really have big individual contributions. Kohler was in the game, had one target. It was incomplete. I think that was the one in the end zone. But he'd had a good blocking game. He did some things positive that I think you've got to include him in the group that helped produce a 307-yard rushing game and did some positive things. The blocking from tight ends, by the way, in this game was not all perfect by any stretch. But I thought Kohler did a pretty good job in terms of making some run blocking headway. All right, who else we got to talk about here? Patrick Ricard, a decent game. I thought you would normally expect him to be just the tip of the spear in the run game, and I didn't think he was bad in that regard. I'm looking at the PFF score. They seem to really rate him down in this game, and he had 36 run blocking attempts. So you have to make kind of a lot of mistakes, I would think, to get a grade in the 40s from PFF on this. But I honestly have not scored him individually the way I score an offensive lineman, so I don't know how they got there. But undoubtedly there were some misses there, and everything was not perfect. Ricard also had a carry in this game, didn't he? Didn't he have one carry for a couple of yards to get a first down? Not, it must have been the last game against New England. So anyway, he did not have one of the carries, but anytime you score, you have 307 rushing yards, you make the kind of commitment with the snaps they had Ricard on the field, as he was on for 40 some snaps, as I recall. Ricard played 43 snaps during the game, so 57% of the time, he had to be a big part of that run offense. Okay, we're going to take a few questions here. Appreciate all the questions that come in through hashtag film study mailbag. Maureen has created a spreadsheet just today. I mentioned in the first half of the show that those questions are now getting categorized, and hopefully I'll be much more efficient at getting your question on the air. And I'm very sorry to the degree that I've left some questions out there to die on the vine, and hopefully that won't happen anymore. I'll start with the first is from DarkSpeed9 on Reddit. And a lot of these are similar. There's a lot of overlap in here. With the incredible success of the run game yesterday, what exactly did our run blocking do so differently than the rest of the regular season? Was it simply overpowering the Packers' D-line, or was the blocking scheme changed/more sound? And will that success continue next week? Well, that's a really compound question there. DarkSpeed9, you have a lot of overlap from other people, so I'm going to leave the next week for part of one of the other questions here. They did a combination of both things. So they still, by the way, anytime you run the ball 53 times, you're going to have some zone and some power, but they had a higher commitment to power in this game, which means dual blocking, means more pulling from the guards. And you see more attempts to puncture the defense with point of attack football, and then get to level 2 for that first contact. Stay ahead of the chains, which they did an outstanding job at in this game. But you asked also, was it something about the Packers' defensive line? And I think it was. I think the Packers were very hurt in this game. I want to look at the defensive linemen and see. I mean, Enagbare played 79% of the snaps. He's an end. Wooden played 68% of the snaps. Van Ness played 62%. Then they had Brinson play 45%. Gary, 45%. He's really a defensive end. Bohanna played 20%. Riley, who got hurt early, that was a big loss for them. He only played 11 snaps. And then Cox played 12% of the snaps. So it sounds like they actually did have a fair amount of dispersal, with only their edge players really taking the absurdly high number of snaps. But they still had some scrambling to do to fill 73 or 74 offensive snaps with the complement of defensive linemen that they needed. Let's move on. Abbas Bokhari. The Steelers didn't have Harmon in the first matchup and still held Henry to 3.8 yards per carry. What adjustments should the Ravens make so that Henry can thrive on Sunday. Well, a couple of adjustments will be made for the Ravens. From starting from a game script perspective, the Ravens should not be as disadvantaged because the Steelers are extremely limited in what they can do offensively. So they're missing key receivers. Calvin Austin may be out again. We know Metcalf will be out with a suspension. And I'm almost 100% sure that I haven't heard officially that Darnell Washington, who's an enormous weapon for them at tight end, and as a blocker, it really gives them a seventh offensive lineman on a lot of plays because they play six offensive line a lot. They'll be limited in terms of what offensive line. We just saw a game against the Browns, you know, where they went into Cleveland and scored 6 points. And yeah, there were some issues with weather, and there was some, the kicker missed a kick there, and they, the situation wasn't perfect. A lot of the Steelers fans thought that the fix was in. You know, that by the way, you want to go out and see some real tinfoil hat stuff, go out to the Steelers boards right now and take a read on the Heinz Field forums or the Steelers Reddit board or whatever. You'll see a lot of tinfoil hat ideas about how the NFL just set this up and they wanted a Week 18 game between the Ravens, and we knew it was going to happen, and we knew it was all set up, and everything was unfair, and the referees killed us and whatnot. I mean, I'd point that group back to 3 weeks ago where the Ravens had a set of very bad calls go against them in the game, including some that the league had to directly apologize. One in particular, the league had to directly apologize to Harbaugh for in a 1 hour phone conversation. That was the Travis Jones over center attempt to on the kick that they ruled whatever the unnecessary roughness or whatever the penalty is for going after the long snapper. The Ravens are very clear, and they may have even told the referees what they were trying to do before the game. Then they had the likely call go against them, which I didn't really think was that bad. It's the Rodgers reception as a receiver where he did not completely meet the same standards that were applied to the likely catch was the flip side of that coin where I thought the Ravens clearly had an interception. But anyway, the tinfoil hat theories are out there. Game was a big fix. The Ravens, the NFL wanted, I love it when the NFL wants something to happen, but the NFL wanted this game to have meaning so they could have it in prime time. Sure enough, it's true. The Ravens are and the Steelers are in prime time. It is pretty much a dream scenario for additional revenue for the NFL. So that's a positive situation from that. It's also one of 272 games they'll play this regular season. So it's not an enormous amount of additional revenue. They basically all the games would drop down one. Maybe the Ravens and Steelers as a rivalry game would be played on Saturday. Maybe not. Maybe be played on sometime on Sunday, and one of the more meaningful playoff games could be moved to Saturday. They had other games they could have rejiggled, and they of course have the NFC South battle for the division title, or the NFC West battle for the division title that they could have put in prime time on Sunday as well. So they have other options. Probably the NFL wants a meaningful game. That's probably not an unreasonable thing to say, but I don't think that they'll cheat to get there. I just don't believe it. I think the credibility of the league is too much of a sacred commodity to screw with. In terms of how can the Ravens do better with Derrick Henry this time, the most important thing is to have a healthy Lamar Jackson, who's more healthy than he was the last time against the Steelers, who could move around and threaten a meaningful read option presence. I think with Tyler Huntley, there is a big risk that the Ravens won't have the ability to out-physical the Steelers in the same way. One of the nice things about Patrick Queen is you can get him to make a lot of unforced errors if you show him eye candy. Remember, Patrick Queen is a rookie in his second year into his third year, was still making a lot of mistakes in terms of not being able to stay with people in coverage if there was any kind of shiny object that would pass across his eyes made him very, very much useless against bunch formations and things where there was natural trickery and picking and rubbing and the other things that were going to go on out of those formations. You show Patrick Queen anything involving the read option, he has trouble figuring out exactly where to go. You get to level two against him with Derrick Henry, he's not real a real big fan of contact. He'll try and twist him down. He'll do the best he can to try and get him to the ground. But Patrick Queen in that playoff game last year had one of the most embarrassing performances. One of the most embarrassing performances you'll ever see from an inside linebacker in terms of a lack of willingness to fight through contact. And it was to such a degree that his agent the next day posted that, I was sick, or he was sick yesterday, and that's why he played the way he did. He got called out by Belichick in terms of what he was trying to do on some film study that was being done. So Patrick Queen is vulnerable, and the Ravens don't have a Lynden Roberts anymore. Peyton Wilson is a pretty good player. So they do have, it's not like they don't have any tacklers, but they just, they don't have the guys in the middle of the field. Deshaun Elliott is another guy who's missing now to make tackles the way they've had in the past. The Ravens got to take care of the football. They're going to have to make sure that every time the Steelers get any kind of score, they have to work the hell for it from the other side of the field, drive all the way up, because it's going to be very difficult for them to do that. And I think that's their onus. So they're probably going to be, in order to do that, they're going to probably have to accept less yards per offensive play. And it may mean less for Henry in terms of yards per play against a more healthy defense that has Derek Harmon back. Of course, you know, the point has been made. TJ Watt's probably not going to play. He might. If he does, he probably won't be the player he's been. So I think, you know, either way, you probably get a good result out of that. The other guys the Steelers have had in there, Herbig and Sawyer, have looked pretty damn good, particularly in this last game against the Browns. And Highsmith is a terror on the blind side. So it's not like the Steelers don't have plenty of weapons there anyway. And Derek Harmon is a big addition back to the middle of that defense to play next to Cam Hayward and provide them with some gap plugging value there. So I think the biggest thing is going to be having Lamar Jackson back, who can threaten the area behind the linebackers so that the Steelers can't completely crowd the line of scrimmage as I feel like they could against Tyler Huntley. All right, next question. Angelove 85, and he's got two here. The first one, hi Ken, I know Green Bay was banged up, but what changes in the run game did you see besides volume, and how can we somewhat replicate that against the Steelers? Also, will a compromised or inactive Watt cancel out Harmon returning? We've actually addressed most of this. So Watt canceling out Harmon returning, I don't know that that's true. I'm not sure at this point whether a 70% Watt or 100% Harmon, who I'm not sure he's at 100% either. I'm not sure who I fear more. Harmon is a pretty good player. He's certainly an interior run stuffer. If you look at tackling grades and whatnot on PFF, they're tremendously poorly skewed. So do this for me. If you want to look at defensive interior and understand just how the tackling grades are, take only the defensive interior players and order them by tackling grade, and only for the players who have 50% or more of the highest snap total. And you'll see that the average score is something like a 46 or something. So within that context, Harmon looks better in terms of the tackling. And Travis Jones, frankly, is way undervalued as a tackle. He's got a 5% missed tackle rate for the year, 5 and change. That obviously is outstanding for an interior defensive player, but somehow the grading's not working properly. All right. So Angelo, I appreciate that. I don't know that I have anything more to add to the run game. One of the things I'd say is that they'll probably stay heavy with heavier personnel after that works so well, until the Steelers prove they can stop it. So we'll see a lot of attempts to replicate the kind of drive level success by getting more average plays and fewer shot plays. With Lamar Jackson, that's really putting a chastity belt on him in a certain way, and maybe one that he's not really thrilled about, but I think it worked so well this last week in terms of the Ravens' efficiency. I think that we want to see more like Lamar 2019 than what we've seen by Lamar 2025 so far. Even though he's been okay at times, he hasn't had the season overall, obviously, that he had that year. Okay, Angelo of 85 also, how does 2025 Huntley and the running game plan match up against the 2025 Steelers defense? I think it's a terrible matchup and that we need LJ back ASAP, but the national media has been saying otherwise. Agree completely. I think in order to have any kind of similar success to either what they had against the Packers or even what they had against the Steelers in the last playoff game. You need to start with having Jackson on the field and the ability to threaten everybody to grass on that field. Once you have that, all misdirection options are back on the table. And frankly, the whole playbook is back on the table. Henry should get a lot of carries. I'm not saying they shouldn't stick with him for more of the actual carries in the game and not, go to Mitchell or even Ali as much in this game. But I think that they'll, they really need to have the threat that the ball could be anywhere, anytime. And you only get that with Lamar Jackson. You really only get it with a healthy Lamar Jackson. I will say this, if Lamar Jackson's back injury is such that he's a shadow of even what he's been for the rest of this year, I could see the wisdom in staying with Tyler Huntley. I don't think it's going to give the Ravens as good a chance to win the game as they are currently projected to have, which is about 62% by gambling markets. But I think that percentage would drop. But I think it might be better than the chance Jackson would give them if Jackson is significantly below 100%. But Harbaugh said it, and there's no inclination, I think, that he would consider playing Huntley over Jackson if Jackson is healthy. And I think one possibility is, that you might start Lamar Jackson, and if it is not working out for some reason, if you have to pull him and it's not due to injury, there's enormous organizational risk with a move like that. I don't think I would want to do it. So if you start Jackson, you're going with Jackson. If you start Huntley, you could go to Jackson. If you say, well, I know you're only at 70%, Lamar, so we're not going to start you in this game, but then we need you. It's the second half. We're down eight. We got to find a way to find the mojo in this offense again. I think you could do that. But I think if you pull Lamar Jackson, then your chance to extend Lamar Jackson probably goes way down. So I think that's the organizational risk I'm talking about. He could have hurt feelings. There is no buffer of an agent in between him who's going to talk him down out of the tree, talk him off the ledge in terms of his feelings about that. So you're at risk. So I think, honestly, the simple answer is just start Jackson, stay with Jackson. That's your only chance to have a really great playoff run. Tyler Huntley is not going to work the Ravens through this maze of, difficult assignments they have facing in the AFC. The AFC is wide open, but also means that every AFC team is pretty tough this year, including the Texans, who is the most likely team that they'll face first. They could then be facing Buffalo in the second game. They could be facing, on the road, either the 2 or 3 seed as well. Sorry, they could be facing the 1, 2, or 3 seed as well on the road. So any of those are possible, and none of them really look easy. Going to Jacksonville is not easy. Going to New England is not going to be easy this year. Going to Denver is not going to be easy. Any road game against one of these very good football teams is going to be a legitimate challenge for this Ravens team. Now, I'm not saying it's never an easy ride in the playoffs, but it's not. Even though people say it's wide open, it's not as. It doesn't mean you can go in as a 6-point favorite everywhere you go. Got one more question here. I really apologize if I butcher the name here, but it's Joao Pedro Bouchot, I'll say. Says, hi, Ken. Never got to contact you because I don't have Twitter, but hey, you're on Instagram now. I've been listening to the podcast since 2021. It's been great to learn much greater depth about football. Thanks. Appreciate it. I'll call you Pedro or JPB. Let's call you JPB. I'm a Brazilian fan, been following the Ravens since the beginning of the 2012 season. I have an idea about a question. We moved away from the pistol formation on offense, which was more prominent in 2019, Lamar's MVP season, to a different formation where Lamar could threaten the middle of the field. Okay, so that's running out of sidecar is what he's referring to, where typically the mesh point is in front of Lamar, and Lamar has complete vision of the field for a probably better array of options to run the ball up the middle and to be able to see how those linebackers are reacting to him. It's definitely involved more injury risk for Lamar for him to be running in the middle of the field, but running the outside field, he had a lot more runs in 2019 where he never got touched. Went out of bounds, 7, 8, 9 yard gain, never got touched. There were a lot of those in that 2019 season. They haven't returned to the pistol. And you know, they running the pistol with a fullback is even something the Ravens have done at times. They can do that either on an offset eye where the fullback is next to Lamar, or they can run a full everything's behind Lamar pistol where you have a fullback in tighter and he leads the way on plays. But they haven't run it much. Mark Ingram was kind of a master of playing with the read option, and he was the primary back in 2019. So Lamar could leave the ball in there until very late. And Ingram's stated position was that Lamar can pull it as late as he wants, as long as he pulls it hard. They did have some fumbles, by the way, that year. That is something to consider as I make this pontification about how good Ingram was at the mesh point. But they did have some problems with fumbles. But the pistol, you know, gave Lamar an option to take some low risk runs to the outside. He certainly did a good job for it. I wouldn't mind. I think they could go back to the pistol. The pistol is highly suited to power blocking. So, you know, you got a running back with a full head of steam going forward. You're not looking to do a zone run typically under those circumstances. You're looking for him to pick a gap A or B between the tackles and make the most of the momentum he's already built by the time he takes that handoff. So you do have options there that I think make a lot of sense in terms of the pistol for what the Ravens seem to have found in these last couple of games with the increased use of power. And that was, of course, in the Roman offense that they did that. So JPB, really appreciate your question. Please say hello to the other Brazilian fans and appreciate you listening in on a regular basis. Last thing I got for you tonight is the MVPs from this game. I don't think there's anything. It's not the last thing I have. I have two more things for you. My number three guy, number three MVP is Tyler Linderbaum. Outstanding game. And the fact that he's number three really says a lot about the performances in this game and just how special they were. It's a tough number two, number three call. My number two guy was Tyler Huntley. Did a lot with his legs in this game, positively. Ran for, what, about 60 yards in the game, in addition to being extremely conservative and careful with the football, avoiding turnovers. Ended up with a 105.6 rating. I don't think that really reflects his level of play. He also ran the ball eight times for 60 yards with a long of 25. So he had some big plays there, including one in the 2-minute drill that helped him get down there. But I thought his game was central to the Ravens being as efficient as they were. And then number one, no doubt about it, is Derrick Henry with his 36 for 216, his records that he set in terms of touchdowns, in terms of moving into the top 10, in terms of the most carries ever by a Raven with 36 in the game. He tied Bam Morris and Priest Holmes, who had previously had 36 in a game. So impressive game, any way you slice it, for Derrick Henry. And he hadn't had a game like that all year. Obviously, he hadn't had a game of 36 carries, but I don't think he'd had 25 carries in a game previously the rest of the year. So impressive that the Ravens were able to lean on him and do so effectively, and for the entire game, down to the last meaningful offensive play when he scored his fourth touchdown. Looking ahead to the Steelers briefly, I'll just get through this as quickly as I can. Ravens get the Sunday night. It's their seventh primetime game of the year. That might be a record. I really don't know, but they're supposed to have a maximum of five scheduled primetime games. That was part of the last CBA, I believe. So I'm surprised that they were able to do this, but obviously there's a carve out for week 17 and week 18 games that they want to have, you know, the best games be there. The Ravens didn't have a primetime game scheduled for either of those. They end up with seven for the year after a flex in week 16 as well versus the Patriots. So they've really kind of gotten hosed with night football. And I know the analyst community probably dislikes it more, particularly the portion of the analyst community which still has another profession other than analyzing football. So if you have a full-time job, having night football makes it tough, and it makes it longer to get the job done after the game. On the plus side, it's an extra day of healing for Lamar Jackson. So Coach made this point. I kind of had forgotten it myself. So you get one extra day of rest relative to Pittsburgh, which I think is good. It will also let Pittsburgh heal up from some of their injuries as well. But I think the fact that they have Lamar coming back from injury potentially, and that extra day could make the difference, is absolutely enormous. So that could be a big reason. And I hope I hope Lamar, you know, had fun on the sideline, and he did it was really good about rooting for Snoop, as far as I could tell. And he put the cheese grater right there on Humphrey's head at the end of the game. It was a very, very nice touch that was there and ready to deal with. But I hope Lamar, and I'm sure Lamar, wants to be back on the field and he's ready to go on Sunday night. The Steelers are very banged up relative to their week 14 game. Harmon is back. Watt is out. Metcalf out. Austin out. Washington out. That's three awfully big receiving weapons. So a disproportionate number of guys on the offensive side. They still are missing their left tackle, Broderick Jones. I'm not sure Dylan Cook isn't better than him at this point. So he's played fairly well since he's been in there as a UDFA left tackle. I still remember the guy coming in and high-fiving everybody along the line. And then he played pretty well in the remainder of that game against the Ravens. And, that just kind of sucked. But the Steelers finding an answer like they have at left tackle is unfortunate, needless to say, for the Ravens. Might be facing even more extreme weather conditions than they did in Green Bay. I don't think it'll be any – well, it could be a little colder, but there definitely could be more wind than there was at Green Bay. And definitely in Pittsburgh is a stadium that is known for some extreme wind right there. Rodgers, in his first game against the Ravens, made all sorts of bucket drop throws in week 14. He also played well in weeks 15 and 16 as they won three straight games before he fell back to earth in this week 17 game against Cleveland. Which Aaron Rodgers the Ravens get is pretty damn important, but I will say not having Metcalf and Austin are going to make dropping the bucket throws more difficult, period. That the recovery speed of Nate Wiggins versus Marquez Valdez-Scantling, who got three of the targets right there on of the four plays that they had to score the touchdown to tie the game against Cleveland. He may be one of the guys that Rodgers is trying to throw to pretty regularly. And Pat Freiermuth as well is certainly not a speedy guy, but he knows how to get open between level two and three. And the Ravens are going to have to really clamp down on that. So hopefully the Ravens are aware of what the Steelers bring in terms of weapons, and they'll be in good shape to at least stop their passing game. The Ravens have been pretty darn effective against most teams in terms of stopping the run. I think this is a team where we'll see the Ravens play more three down linemen against the Steelers six offensive line looks. Now the Ravens just got over a game with the Packers where they didn't respect the Packers six man offensive line at all. They only played two snaps of it, but the Ravens never once in this game went to three down linemen. They played every single snap of the game with two or fewer down linemen. In fact, they played two snaps with zero down linemen in when they had the race car on the field late in the game. But they were looking to stop Malik Willis, and they actually were kind of slow to change to being lighter, more looking like the upfront personnel they use in the dime with three outside linebackers on the field a lot of the time. But they never had three defensive linemen on the line of scrimmage. So, a nice adaptation by Orr that still obviously wasn't particularly effective against Green Bay for other than stopping the run. They stopped the run from the running backs very effectively with seven carries for 19 yards. They didn't stop Willis at all. Most of his was losing contain to the outside, and particularly that left side, and on a few scrambles out of the pocket where he left a pocket flushed and was able to pick up some yards and some conversions. So hopefully Rodgers does not pose that kind of threat. I think we can fairly state that, and they won't let him run around and extend and make plays the same way, and they should be in a position to better cover the receivers that are on the other side of those passes as well. So I kind of like the chances the Ravens have on defense to stop them, and stopping the run, I'm sure, will be a priority. I think no matter what, that bad weather probably does favor the Steelers, that anything that could risk potentially compressing the field takes away potentially more of what Lamar Jackson can do than it takes away what Rodgers can do. So I'd be afraid of that if you take away the Ravens' misdirection in the run game, they're right back where they started, and that the Steelers will be able to compete in the game, and it could be a low scoring slog fest that ends up 13-10 or 16-13. And that's not the kind of score the Ravens want in this game. They want to have a highly efficient, well-oiled offensive machine grinding the Steelers to dust in this game if they possibly can. Anyway, that's all the look ahead we'll do in this one. We have episodes. We'll have a matchup, a pair of matchups episode this week, and I Know Your Foe coming later this week. We'll talk much more about that. So look for those on filmstudybaltimore.com or your favorite podcast platform. As always, thanks for listening. Happy New Year. Be safe and use hashtag filmstudymailbag for your questions. And also, if you don't mind, write us a 5-star, 50-word review on your favorite podcast platform. That we appreciate, and it drives traffic to the show. Thanks much, and we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.